Monroe Doctrine to the Marshall Plan, they were the warp and woof of a resilient foreign policy. America's great historical moments, writes historian Bernard Balin, have occurred when realism and idealism have been combined, and no one knew this better than Franklin. As he would prove in France, Franklin not only knew how to play a calculated balance of power game like the best practitioner of real politic, but he also knew how to play with his other hand the rousing chords of America's exceptionalism, the sense that America stood apart from the rest of the world because of its virtuous nature. Both the hard power that came from its strategic might and the soft power that flowed from the appeal of its ideals and culture would, he realized, be equally important in assuring its influence. In his diplomacy as in his personal business, he was a man who believed in the power of reason and the reality of virtue, declared the writer and mathematician Condorcet, who became one of his best French friends. So, after writing Vergennes, a memo infused with classic diplomatic realism, Franklin settled down in Passy to pursue the gambit of drawing power from America's idealism. He arranged for the inspiring documents coming out of America, including the Constitution he had written for Pennsylvania, to be translated and published as a way of winning hearts and minds in France and elsewhere. "All Europe is for us," he wrote the Committee of Secret Correspondence in a letter that explained his rationale for publishing those documents. Then he went on to give a classic formulation of the lure of America's ideals. "Tyranny is so generally established in the rest of the world that the prospect of an asylum in America for those who love liberty gives general joy, and our cause is esteemed the cause of all mankind." He ended by echoing the shining city upon a hill metaphor to be used by the great American exceptionalists from John Winthrop to Ronald Reagan. "We are fighting for the dignity and happiness of human nature," he proclaimed. "Glorious it is for the Americans to be called by Providence to this post of honor." A few weeks later, he wrote in a similar vein to a Boston friend, concluding, "It is a common observation here that our cause is the cause of all mankind, and that we are fighting for their liberty in defending our own." Franklin's public diplomacy strategy puzzled Vergennes. "I really do not know what Franklin has come to do here," he wrote. "At the beginning, we thought he had all sorts of projects, but all of a sudden he has shut himself up in sanctuary with the philosophe." The French minister rejected America's proposal for an immediate alliance, deflected requests for further meetings, and kept his distance from Franklin for a few months, waiting to see how the war evolved. He did, however, quietly offer some aid. France would make another secret loan to America and allow its ports to be used by American merchant ships. Franklin also waged his public relations campaign, as he had in England, with some anonymous pieces in the press. The most powerful was a brutal parody, along the lines of an edict by the King of Prussia, that he wrote shortly after his first meeting with Vergennes. It purported to be a letter to the commander of the Hessian troops in America from a German count who got paid a bounty for the death of each of the soldiers he sent over. Because Britain had decided not to pay for any wounded soldiers, only for those who died, the count encouraged his commander to make sure that as many died as possible. "I do not mean by this that you should assassinate them. We should be humane, my dear Baron. But you may insinuate to the surgeons with entire propriety that a crippled man is a reproach to their profession, and that there is no wiser course than to let every one of them die when he ceases to be fit to fight. You will therefore promise promotion to all who expose themselves. You will exhort them to seek glory in the midst of dangers." He also used his wit to parry the propaganda reports being spread by the British ambassador, Lord Stormont. Asked about one of these reports, Franklin retorted, "It is not a truth, it is only a Stormont." After that, he and fashionable Paris began using the ambassador's name as a verb, stormonté, a weak pun on the French verb mentir, meaning to lie. Wild rumors began to circulate about Franklin's various strategies and schemes in France. One British spy, not Bancroft, reported that Franklin was preparing a great number of reflecting mirrors that would be placed on the Calais coast to focus the heat from the sun on the British Navy, thus destroying it. That would be followed by an electric shock sent over a cross-channel chain that would disrupt the entire British island. The New Jersey Gazette went further. Franklin was inventing an electrical apparatus that could shift land masses, and a method of using oil that could still the waves in one place while stirring up tempests in another. Alas, what he was actually doing was more mundane, such as coping with European supplicants who sought commissions to serve as officers in the American army. His collected letters are clogged with requests, more than 400 in all, some valiant and others vain. "Not a day passes in which I have not a number of soliciting visits besides letters," he complained. "You can have no conception how I am harassed." There was the mother who offered up three of her flock of sons, the Dutch surgeon who wanted to study bodies that had been blown apart, and the Benedictine monk who promised to pray for America if it would pay off his gambling debts. Franklin's favorite was a less than effusive recommendation he received from a mother, which began, "Sir, if in your America one knows the secret of how to reform a detestable subject who has been the cross of his family..." The case of one such supplicant showed how Franklin's difficulty in saying no made him an easy mark. An Irishman living in Paris named William Parsons wrote Franklin a pitiful letter describing his unfortunate plight and begging for a commission to join the American army. Franklin did not offer him a recommendation, but he did lend him 15 guineas, which Parsons then absconded with to England, leaving his poor wife behind. When the wife wrote Franklin a sad letter accusing him of causing her husband to leave, Franklin denied that he had given him any encouragement, wrote off the 15-guinea loan, and sent along another guinea to help the wife buy food. For the next 3 months, she peppered him with pleas for even more relief. Not all the supplicants were vagabonds. Franklin was able to find, among those seeking commissions, a few great officers to recommend. The Marquis de Lafayette, Baron von Steuben, whose rank in the Prussian army Franklin inflated in his eagerness to get General Washington to take him, and Count Pulaski, a famed Polish fighter who became a heroic brigadier general for America. Nevertheless, Washington quickly grew testy about the number of aspiring officers Franklin was sending his way. "Our corps being already formed and fully officered," he wrote, "every new arrival is only a source of embarrassment to Congress and myself, and of disappointment and chagrin to the gentlemen who come over." So Franklin tried as best he could to reject most of the commission seekers, or provide them only with letters that used such phrases as, "goes over at his own expense, contrary to my advice." To cope with the constant flood of requests, or perhaps merely to make fun of them, Franklin even composed a form letter, which he had printed up. "The bearer of this, who is going to America, presses me to give him a letter of recommendation, though I know nothing of him, not even his name," it read. "I must refer you to himself for his character and merits, with which he is certainly better acquainted than I can possibly be." In September 1777, Franklin and his fellow commissioners went to press Vergennes again for French recognition. And, as if to conceal the weakness of their position, to request 7 times more aid than had already been given. It was an inauspicious meeting for 2 reasons. Before it even happened, the spying Bancroft had leaked details of the planned request to Ambassador Stormont, who protested it to Vergennes, who then chided the Americans for being so unguarded. In addition, shortly after the meeting, news arrived that British General Howe had captured Philadelphia. Howe's success was a personal blow for Franklin. His house on Market Street was commandeered by a British captain named John André, who, as the Beaches took refuge in the countryside, stole his electrical equipment, books, musical instruments, and an elegant portrait of him that had been painted by Benjamin Wilson in 1759. It was returned from England in 1906 and now hangs on the 2nd floor of the White House. For America, it threatened to be an even worse blow. Howe was in Philadelphia, and General Burgoyne was heading down the Hudson. If and when the 2 British armies linked, New England would be cut off from the rest of the colonies. Nonetheless, Franklin kept his equanimity. Told of Howe's triumph, he replied, "You mistake the matter. Instead of Howe taking Philadelphia, Philadelphia has taken Howe." On one level, it seemed a flippant bon mot. On another, it was a shrewd assessment. If Burgoyne was slowed in his move down the Hudson, and if Howe did not press northward to reinforce him, both could end up isolated. Arthur Lee wanted to use America's precarious position to present an ultimatum to the French. Either they join America in a military alliance immediately, or else America would be forced to reconcile with Britain. "Dr. Franklin was of a different position," Lee recorded in his journal. "The effect of such a declaration," Franklin argued, "might make them abandon us in despair or anger." He felt that America would eventually gain a position that would make it in France's own interest to want an alliance. He was right. Shortly before noon on December 4th, a messenger from America galloped into the courtyard of Passy bearing a message from the front. Franklin asked if, as he had already heard, Philadelphia had fallen. "Yes, sir," said the messenger. Franklin turned his back. "But, sir, I have greater news than that," said the messenger. "General Burgoyne and his whole army are prisoners." Burgoyne had been defeated at the Battle of Saratoga, and now Howe was indeed isolated. The very dramatic dramatist Beaumarchais, who happened to be at Passy at the time, was eager to use the inside news to speculate in the stock markets. He raced back to Paris at such a high speed that his cabriolet overturned, fracturing his arm. Bancroft also immediately scurried off, heading for London to consult with his spy masters. He would also have speculated, but the news reached London before he did. Franklin, far calmer than his odd friends, wrote up a news release filled with little details and large exaggerations. "Mail arrived from Philadelphia at Dr. Franklin's house in Passy after 34 days. On October 14th, General Burgoyne was forced to lay down his arms. 9,200 men killed or taken prisoner. General Howe is in Philadelphia, where he is imprisoned. all communication with his fleet is cut off. Howe was not, in fact, trapped, nor was America on the verge of victory. Still, the British surrender at Saratoga was a great turning point on the battlefield, and, because Franklin knew that power on the battlefield correlated to power at the bargaining table, it was a great turning point for his diplomatic efforts. The note he wrote to Vergennes that afternoon was more restrained than his news release. "We have the honor to acquaint Your Excellency," it began, "with advice of the total reduction of the force under General Burgoyne." 2 days later, Louis XVI, from his chamber at Versailles, put his royal assent on a gilt-edged paper, prepared for him by Vergennes, that invited the Americans to resubmit their request for a formal alliance. In delivering the message, Vergennes' secretary added that it could be done none too soon. The Treaties of Friendship and Alliance. After a full year of deflecting requests for an alliance, the French were suddenly impatient as 1777 drew to a close. They were prodded not only by America's success at Saratoga and the completion of their own naval rearmament program, but also by a new gambit by Franklin. He began to play the French and British off against one another and to let each side discover, and here is where he relied on the spies he knew were in his midst, how eager the other side was for a deal. Franklin wrote a renewed proposal for a French-American alliance on December 7th. Temple delivered it the next day, and within a week the three American commissioners were meeting with Vergennes. The French quickly agreed to full recognition of America and treaties of trade and alliance. There was one caveat. France needed the approval of Spain. As the two countries had pledged in the Bourbon Family Pact of 1761 to act in concert, Vergennes sent his courier to Madrid and promised the Americans they would have a response in 3 weeks. In the meantime, the British sent to Paris the most trusted envoy they could muster, Paul Wentworth, their able spymaster. At the time, Wentworth was angry with his secret agent Bancroft for sending inside information to his stock-speculating partner before sending it to Wentworth, who was also a speculator. King George III, upset by the bad news that his spies were giving him, denounced them all as untrustworthy stock manipulators, but he reluctantly approved Wentworth's secret peace mission. Wentworth arrived in Paris in mid-December, just as the Americans were meeting with Vergennes, and sent a missive to Silas Deane that was worthy of a British spy. A gentleman who wished to meet him, it said, could be found the next morning in a coach at a specified place on the road to Passy, or later at an exhibition in the Luxembourg Gallery, or at the public baths on the Seine, where Deane would find a note giving the room number to use. Deane sent a reply worthy of an American. He would be in his office, where he would be happy to see anyone who wanted to come by. At dinner with Deane, Wentworth proposed a plan for reconciliation between Britain and her colonies. America would have its own Congress, would be subject to Parliament only in matters of foreign policy and trade, and all the offensive acts passed since 1763 would be repealed. He also offered personal inducements, knighthoods, peerages, jobs, money, to Deane or any American who helped secure such a peace. Franklin, at first, refused to meet with Wentworth. But then word came of Spain's answer to France's proposal for an alliance with America. Somewhat surprisingly, The Spanish king had rejected the plan and declared that Spain saw no reason to recognize America. It would now be up to France to act alone if it so chose. So, during the first week of 1778, Franklin applied pressure. He let word leak to the press that British emissaries were in town and that they might reach a pact with the Americans if the French did not do so promptly. Such a pact, the stories went, might even include American support for Britain's efforts to capture France's islands in the West Indies. He also agreed to meet with Wentworth on January 6th, though he made him promise not to offer any personal bribes. Wentworth's report back to London was written in the clumsy code that might be expected from an agent who had tried to set up a secret rendezvous in a bathhouse. "I called on 72, Franklin, yesterday, and found him very busy with his nephew, either Jonathan Williams or more likely Temple, who was directed to leave the room, and we remained together 2 hours before 51, Dean, joined us, when the conversation ceased." Wentworth added that he had offered to Franklin an unsigned letter that spoke of the possibility of unqualified 107, which was the code he used for independence. "Franklin said it was a very interesting, sensible letter," Wentworth reported, and applauded the candor, good sense, and benevolent spirit of it. Then he added the kicker, "Pity it did not come a little sooner." Not quite sure who was spying on whom, Franklin pursued the cleverly naive approach he had described a year earlier. It was in his interest that the British discover, as they did through their spy Bancroft, how close the Americans were to a deal with France. And it was in his interest that the French discover, as they did through their own constant surveillance of Wentworth, that the Americans were having discussions with a British emissary. Everything he said to Wentworth, he was happy to have the French overhear. As Yale historian Jonathan Dull has noted, the ineptitude of the British government presented Franklin with a chance to play one of his best diplomatic roles, the innocent, who may not be so innocent as he pretends. Indeed, Franklin's meeting with Wentworth seemed to prod the French. 2 days later, Vergennes' secretary called on the Americans. He had only one question. "What is necessary to be done to give such satisfaction to the American commissioners as to engage them not to listen to any proposition from England for a new connection with that country?" Thanks to Franklin's maneuvers, as well as the victory of Saratoga, the French now wanted an alliance as eagerly as America did. Franklin personally wrote out the answer. "The commissioners have long since proposed a treaty of amity and commerce which is not yet concluded. The immediate conclusion of that treaty will remove the uncertainty they are under with regard to it and give them such a reliance on the friendship of France as to reject firmly all propositions made to them of peace from England, which have not for their basis the entire freedom and independence of America." That was all the French now needed to hear. Franklin was told that the king would assent to the treaties, one on friendship and trade, the other creating a military alliance, even without the participation of Spain. France made one stipulation. America could not make peace with Britain in the future without France's consent. And so the treaties of friendship and alliance were won. The treaties had an important aspect. They did not violate the idealistic view held by Franklin and others that America, in its virgin purity, should avoid becoming entangled in foreign alliances or European spheres of influence. The commercial rights that the Americans granted were mutual, non-exclusive, and permitted a system of open and free trade with other nations. No monopoly of our trade was granted, Franklin pointed out in a letter to Congress. None are given to France but what we are at liberty to grant to any other nation. The American commissioners met in Paris on February 5, 1778, for the signing of the treaty. Vergennes' secretary had a cold, however, so the ceremony was put off for a day. At both gatherings, Franklin appeared without his usual brown coat. Instead, he wore a suit of blue Manchester velvet that was faded and a bit worn. Silas Deane, finding this puzzling, asked why. "To give it a little revenge," Franklin answered. "I wore this coat the day Wedderburn abused me at Whitehall." It had been 4 years since his humiliation in the cockpit, and he had saved the suit for such an occasion. Standing near Franklin, ready to assist, was his supposedly loyal secretary, Edward Bancroft. The British spy took the document, made a copy, hired a special messenger, and got it to the ministers in London within 42 hours. He had already, 2 weeks earlier, written coded letters in invisible ink that provided the outline of what the treaty would contain, plus the intelligence that a French convoy of 3 ships and 2 war frigates was preparing to leave Quiberon to bring the document back to an anxious American Congress. He also sent word that, "We have just received a letter from the Prussian ministry to say that the King of Prussia will immediately follow France in acknowledging the independency of America." Years later, when he was haggling with the British over back pay, Bancroft wrote a secret memo telling the Foreign Secretary that this was "information for which many individuals here would, for purposes of speculation, have given me more than all that I have received from the government." In fact, Bancroft had indeed used this information to make money speculating on the markets. He had sent £420 to his stock partner in England, the Philadelphia-born merchant Samuel Wharton, and provided him word of the impending treaties so that it could be used to short stocks. "The bulls in the alley are likely to be left in the lurch," he wrote in one secret missive to Wharton, using invisible ink. That letter was intercepted by the English spy service, but others made it through to Wharton, and also to their other partner, the British banker Thomas Walpole. Bancroft ended up making £1,000 in the transactions. Louis XVI made the Franco-American treaties official by receiving the 3 commissioners at Versailles on March 20th. Crowds gathered at the palace gates to catch a glimpse of the famous American, and they shouted, "Vive Franklin!" as his coach passed through the gold-crested gates. Among those in the courtyard were, according to Susan Mary Alsop, the officious porters who rented out to visitors the ceremonial swords that were generally required for admission to the palace. The other American commissioners each wore one, along with the other items of official court dress. But not Franklin. Seeing no reason to abandon the simple style that had served him well, he dressed in a plain brown suit with his famous spectacles as his only adornment. He did not wear a sword, and when he discovered that the wig he had bought for the occasion did not sit well on his head, decided to forsake it as well. "I should have taken him for a big farmer," wrote one female observer, so great was his contrast with the other diplomats, who were all powdered in full dress and splashed all over with gold and ribbons. His one fashion concession to the occasion was that he did not wear his fur cap, but instead carried a hat of pure white under his arm. "Is that white hat a symbol of liberty?" asked Madame du Deffant. The old aristocrat at whose salon Franklin had worn his fur cap. Whether or not he meant it to be, white hats for men were soon in vogue in Paris, as everything else Franklin wore was wont to become. When Franklin was ushered into the king's bedchamber at noon, after the official levee, Louis XVI was in a posture of prayer. "I hope this will be for the good of both nations," he said, giving a royal imprimatur to America's status as an independent nation. On a personal note, he added, "I am very satisfied with your conduct since you arrived in my kingdom." After a mid-afternoon dinner hosted by Vergennes, Franklin had the honor, if not pleasure, of being allowed to stand next to the queen, the famously haughty Marie Antoinette, as she played at the gambling tables. Alone among the throng at Versailles, she seemed to have little appreciation for the man who, she had been told, had once been a printer's foreman. As she noted dismissively, a man of that background would never have been able to rise so high in Europe. Franklin would have proudly agreed. Franklin's diplomatic triumph would help seal the course of the revolution. It would also alter the world's balances of power, not just between France and England, but also, though France certainly did not intend it to, between republicanism and monarchy. "Franklin had won," writes Karl van Doren, "a diplomatic campaign equal in results to Saratoga." The Yale historian Edmund Morgan goes even further, calling it the greatest diplomatic victory the United States has ever achieved. With the possible exception of the creation of the NATO alliance, that assessment may be true, though it partly points up the paucity of American successes over the years at bargaining tables, whether in Versailles after World War I or in Paris at the end of the Vietnam War. At the very least, it can be said that Franklin's triumph permitted America the possibility of an outright victory in its war for independence, while conceding no lasting entanglements that would encumber it as a new nation. Before word of the treaty reached Philadelphia, the Congress had been debating whether to consider the new peace offers that had arrived from Britain. Now, after only 2 days of deliberation, it decided instead to ratify the alliance with France. "You cannot conceive what joy the treaties with France have diffused among all true Americans," Franklin's friend Samuel Cooper wrote from Massachusetts. Chapter 14. Bon Vivant. Paris, 1778 through 1785. John Adams. In April 1778, shortly after the American treaties with France had been signed, John Adams arrived in Paris to replace the recalled Silas Deane as one of the three American commissioners. The French were not thrilled by the switch. "Mr. Deane," reported Edward Bancroft to his spy masters in London, "is highly esteemed here, and his successor, J. Adams, is much distrusted." Bancroft reported that Adams was also unhappy. "Adams is heartily disappointed to find everything done and talks of returning." When they served together in the Congress, Adams had initially distrusted Franklin, then gone through a blender of emotions, bemusement, resentment, admiration, and jealousy. On their trip to negotiate with Lord Howe on Staten Island, when they shared a bed and open window, he had found Franklin both amusing and annoying. So when he arrived in Paris, it was probably inevitable that he and Franklin would, as they did, enjoy and suffer a complex mix of disdain and grudging admiration for one another. Some have found the relationship baffling. Did Adams resent or respect Franklin? Did Franklin find Adams maddening or solid? Did they like or dislike each other? The answer, which is not all that baffling because it is often true of the relationship between two great and strong people, is that they felt all of these conflicting emotions about each other and more. They were both very smart, but otherwise they had quite different personalities. Adams was unbending and outspoken and argumentative. Franklin, charming and taciturn and flirtatious. Adams was rigid in his personal morality and lifestyle. Franklin, famously playful. Adams learned French by poring over grammar books and memorizing a collection of funeral orations. Franklin, who cared little about the grammar, learned the language by lounging on the pillows of his female friends and writing them amusing little tales. Adams felt comfortable confronting people, whereas Franklin preferred to seduce them, and the same was true of the way they dealt with nations. Adams, who was 42 when he arrived, was 30 years younger than Franklin, and about 5 years younger than Franklin's son William. More sensitive to insults, real and imagined, Adams came to feel more strongly about Franklin than vice versa. At times he was driven almost to distraction by Franklin's insouciance and self-indulgence. He envied and suspected people with no rough edges, people who moved easily in the finer circles. Berkeley historian Robert Middlecoff writes of Adams in his textured study, Benjamin Franklin and His Enemies. He was incapable of the easy gesture, and incapable, too, of the small hypocrisies that carry other men through life. David McCullough, in his masterly biography of Adams, is more sympathetic and balanced about him, but he too conveys the rich complexity of his attitudes toward Franklin. Most of Adams's resentments were occasioned by ill-disguised jealousy at being overshadowed. Franklin had a monopoly of reputation here and an indecency in displaying it, Adams complained to a friend after a few months in Paris. But in reading some of the unkind things he had to say about Franklin, it is important to note that at one time or another, Adams hurled a few nasty adjectives at just about everyone he met. For instance, he once described George Washington as a muttonhead. Despite their personal friction, Adams and Franklin were bound together by their shared patriotism and their ardor for America's independence. Franklin took Adams under his wing at Passy, enrolled 10-year-old John Quincy Adams at Benny Bache's boarding school, and took his new colleague on all of his social and cultural rounds, including his grand embrace of Voltaire at the Académie. On Adams's first day at Passy, Franklin brought him along to dine at the home of Jacques Turgot, the former finance minister, and then on subsequent days to the salons of the various women whose seductive styles entranced Franklin and appalled Adams. Even more appalling to the puritanical Adams was Franklin's living and work style. He was disturbed by what he assumed to be the cost of the luxurious accommodations at Passy, then even more upset when he learned that the ambitious Chaumont was charging them no rent. Soon after his arrival, Adams vented in his diary about the difficulty of getting Franklin to focus on work. "I found out that the business of our commission would never be done unless I did it. The life of Dr. Franklin was a scene of continual dissipation. It was late when he breakfasted, and as soon as breakfast was over, a crowd of carriages came to his levee. Some philosophers, academicians, and economists, some of his small tribe of humble friends in the literary way, whom he employed to translate some of his ancient compositions, such as his Bonhomme Richard, and, for what I know, his Polly Baker, etc. But by far the greater part were women and children, come to have the honor to see the great Franklin, and to have the pleasure of telling stories about his simplicity, his bald head. He was invited to dine every day, and never declined unless we had invited company to dine with us. I was always invited with him, till I found it necessary to send apologies, that I might have some time to study the French language and do the business of the mission. Mr. Franklin kept a horn book always in his pocket, in which he minuted all his invitations to dinner, and Mr. Lee said it was the only thing in which he was punctual. In these agreeable and important occupations and amusements the afternoon and evening was spent, and he came home at all hours from 9 to 12 o'clock at night. One of Franklin's French friends put a more positive spin on his work habits.
"He would eat, sleep, work whenever he saw fit, according to his needs, so that there was never a more leisurely man, though he certainly handled a tremendous amount of business."
These two descriptions of Franklin's style reveal not just differing views about him, but also differing views about work. Franklin was always industrious, and in America he famously believed in also giving the appearance of being industrious. But in France, where the appearance of pleasure was more valued, Franklin knew how to adopt the style. As Claudin Lopez notes, in colonial America it was sinful to look idle. In France, it was vulgar to look busy. One day a Frenchman asked Adams whether he was surprised that Franklin never attended any religious services.
"No," Adams replied, laughing, "because Mr. Franklin has no—"
Adams did not finish the sentence for fear of seeming too blasphemous.
"Mr. Franklin adores only great nature," said the Frenchman, "which has interested a great many people of both sexes in his favor."
"Yes," replied Adams, "all the atheists, deists, and libertines, as well as all the philosophers and ladies, are in his train."
"Yes," the Frenchman continued, "he is celebrated as the great philosopher and the great legislator of America."
Adams was unable to control his resentment.
"He is a great philosopher, but as the legislator of America he has done very little," he told the Frenchman. "It is universally believed in France, England, and all Europe that his electric wand has accomplished all this revolution, but nothing is more groundless. He did not even make the Constitution of Pennsylvania, bad as it is."
Adams, who was not as much of a Democrat as Franklin and believed in checks on the power of the people, strongly objected to the unicameral legislature. After a few years, Franklin would tire of Adams and declare that he was sometimes and in some things absolutely out of his senses. But for the time being, he found Adams tolerable, at times even admirable, and he was happy to make him part of his social set, despite Adams's minimal enthusiasm for such frivolities. Voltaire. The philosophes of France were, like Franklin, eager to engage in the real world rather than lose themselves in abstruse metaphysics. Their secular version of the Bible was the Encyclopédie, compiled by Diderot, which included articles by Turgot on economics, Montesquieu on politics, Rousseau on the arts, Condorcet on sciences, and Helvétius on man.
reigning as their king and god, or perhaps neither, as he was skeptical of both, was Voltaire, a man who contributed anonymously to the Encyclopédie, but prominently to the intellectual life of France. Voltaire and Franklin were, at least in the mind of the French public, soulmates. Both were aging embodiments of the wit and reason of the Enlightenment, playful yet pointed parodists, debunkers of orthodoxy and pretense, disciples of deism, tribunes of tolerance, and apostles of revolution. So it was inevitable not only that the two sages would meet, but also that their meetings would, even more than the one between Franklin and the king himself, capture the public imagination. By early 1778, Voltaire was 84 and ailing, and there had even been stories that he had died. His retort, even better than Mark Twain's similar one, was that the reports were true, only premature. In February, Franklin paid a ceremonial visit to his home and asked him to give his blessing to 7-year-old Benny Bache. As 20 awed disciples watched and shed tears of tenderness, Voltaire put his hands on the boy's head and pronounced, in English, "God and liberty." According to Condorcet, one of the witnesses, he added, "This is the only appropriate benediction for the grandson of Monsieur Franklin." Some derided the rather histrionic display. One of Paris's more caustic papers accused them of playing out a scene of puerile adulation. And when former Massachusetts Governor Hutchinson heard of the God and Liberty benediction, he remarked that it was difficult to say which of those words had been most used to bad purposes. Mainly, however, the encounter was reverentially publicized throughout Europe. Franklin and Voltaire staged an even more dramatic meeting at the Académie Royale on April 29th of that year. Franklin was dressed with trademark simplicity. Plain coat, no wig, and no adornments other than his spectacles. Voltaire, who would die within a month, was gaunt and frail. The crowd demanded that they give each other a French embrace, an act that evoked, in the words of Condorcet, such noisy acclamation, one would have said it was Solon who embraced Sophocles. The comparison to the great Greek philosophers, one famous for his laws and the other for his literature, was proclaimed throughout Europe, as eyewitness John Adams reported, with his typical mix of awe and resentment. There was a general cry that Monsieur Voltaire and Monsieur Franklin should be introduced to each other. This was no satisfaction. There must be something more. Neither of our philosophers seemed to divine what was wished or expected. They, however, took each other by the hand. But this was not enough. The clamor continued until the explanation came out. Il faut s'embrasser à la française. The two aged actors upon this great theater of philosophy and frivolity then embraced each other by hugging one another in their arms and kissing each other's cheeks, and then the tumult subsided. And the cry immediately spread through the kingdom, and I suppose all over Europe, qu'il est charmant de voir embrasser Solon et Sophocle. The Académie served as one of Franklin's bases among the intellectual elite of Paris. Another was a remarkable Masonic lodge known in honor of the Muses as the Lodge of the Nine Sisters. Freemasonry in France was evolving from being just a set of businessmen's social clubs, which is what it mainly was in America, and was becoming part of the movement led by the philosophes and other freethinkers who challenged the orthodoxies of both the church and the monarchy. Claude Adrien Helvétius, a very free-thinking philosophe, had first envisaged a super lodge in Paris that would be filled with the greatest writers and artists. When he died, his widow, Madame Helvétius, about whom we will soon hear a lot more, helped fund its creation in 1776. Franklin and Voltaire joined the Lodge of the Nine Sisters in April 1778, the same month as their public meeting at the Académie. The Lodge provided Franklin with influential supporters and enjoyable evenings. But it was risky. Both the king and the clerics were wary of the Renegade Lodge and of Franklin's membership in it. The controversy surrounding the lodge was heightened when in November 1778 it held a memorial service for Voltaire, who, on his deathbed a few months earlier, had waved off priests seeking to give him last rites. Some friends, such as Condorcet and Diderot, thought it wise to avoid the ceremony. But Franklin not only attended, he took part in it. The hall was draped in black, lit only dimly by candles. There were songs, speeches, and poems attacking the clergy and absolutism in all forms. Voltaire's niece presented a bust by Houdon. Houdon, a member, also did a bust of Franklin for the lodge, which is now in the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Then a flame of light revealed a grand painting of the apotheosis of Voltaire emerging from his tomb to be presented in heaven by the goddesses of truth and benevolence. Franklin took the Masonic wreath from his head and solemnly laid it at the foot of the painting. Everyone then adjourned to the banquet room, where the first toast included a tribute to Franklin, the captive thunder dying at his feet, and to America. Louis XVI, though a Mason himself, was annoyed by the spectacle, and worked through the other Masonic lodges to have the Nine Sisters expelled. After months of controversy, the situation was resolved when the Nine Sisters reorganized itself and Franklin took over as its venerable or grand master. During the ensuing years, Franklin would induct many Americans into the lodge, including his grandson Temple, the spy Edward Bancroft, and the naval warrior John Paul Jones. He also helped create from within the lodge a group somewhat akin to his American Philosophical Society, known as the Société Apollonienne. Madame Brion. As fascinating as the Freemasons and Philosophes were, it was not for his male friends that Franklin was famous in France. Among his many reputations was that of a legendary and lecherous old lover who had many mistresses among the ladies of Paris. The reality, truth be told, was somewhat less titillating. His famed female friends were mistresses only of his mind and soul. Yet that hardly made their relationships less interesting. The first of these was with a talented and high-strung neighbor in Passy, Madame Brion de Jouy, an accomplished musician who was noted for her performances on the harpsichord and the new pianos that were becoming fashionable in France. When she first met Franklin in the spring of 1777, she worried that she had been too shy to make a good impression. So the next day she asked a mutual friend to send her some of the Scottish melodies she knew Franklin loved. "I would try to play them and compose some in the same style," she wrote. "I do wish to provide the great man with some moments of relaxation from his occupations, and also to have the pleasure of seeing him." Thus began their intense companionship, which soon became sexually charged and the fodder for much gossip. Adams and others were shocked by what Madame Brion called her sweet habit of sitting on your lap, and by stories of their late nights spent together. "I am certain you have been kissing my wife. her husband once wrote Franklin. Yet Monsieur Brion added in his letter, "My dear doctor, let me kiss you back in return."
Franklin's relationship with Madame Brion, like so many of his others with distinguished ladies, was complex and never fully consummated. It was, as Claudin Lopez has ably described, an amitié amoureuse in which Franklin had to settle for playing the role of cher papa, an oddly flirtatious father. Madame Brion, who was 33 when she met Franklin, was buffeted by conflicting passions and variable moods. Her husband, 24 years her senior, but 14 years younger than Franklin, was wealthy, doting, and unfaithful. She had two daughters with beautiful singing voices and lived in one of the most elegant estates in Passy. Yet she was prone to fits of depression and self-pity. Although she spoke no English, she and Franklin exchanged more than 130 letters during their 8-year relationship, and she was able not only to enchant him, but also to manipulate him. She did so by composing and playing music for him, creating a salon around him, and writing him flattering letters in French and in the third person. "It is," she declared, "a real source of joy for her to think that she can sometimes amuse Mr. Franklin, whom she loves and esteems as he deserves." When the Americans won the Battle of Saratoga, she composed a triumphal overture entitled Marche des Saint-Sulgents, which is still sometimes performed, and played it for him in a private concert. They also flirted over the chessboard. "She is still a little miffed," Madame Brion teasingly wrote of herself, "about the 6 games of chess he won so inhumanly, and she warns him she will spare nothing to get her revenge." By March 1778, after months of just music and chess, Franklin was ready for something more. So he shocked her with some of his libertine theology and challenged her to save his soul. "You were kind enough," she wrote, now comfortable in the first person, "to entrust me with your conversion." Her propositions were promising, even suggestive. "I know my penitent's weak spot. I shall tolerate it. As long as he loves God, America, and me above all things, I absolve him of all of his sins, present, past, and future." Madame Brion went on to describe the 7 cardinal sins, merrily noting that he had conquered well the first 6, ranging from pride to sloth. When she got to the 7th, the sin of lust, she became a bit coy. "The 7th? I shall not name it. All great men are tainted with it. You have loved, my dear brother. You have been kind and lovable. You have been loved in return. What is so damnable about that?" "She promises to lead me to heaven along a road so delicious," Franklin exulted in his reply to her. "I am in raptures when I think of being absolved of the future sins." Turning to the 10 commandments, he argued that there were actually 2 others that should be included: to multiply and fill the earth, and to love one another. He had always obeyed those 2 very well, he argued. "And should not that compensate for my having so often failed to respect 1 of the 10? I mean the one which forbids us to covet thy neighbor's wife, a commandment which, I confess, I have consistently violated." Alas, Madame Brion took that cue to beat a hasty retreat. "I dare not decide the question without consulting that neighbor whose wife you covet," she wrote, referring to her husband. There was, she explained, a double standard she must obey. "You are a man, I am a woman,
and while we might think along the same lines, we must speak and act differently. Perhaps there is no great harm in a man having desires and yielding to them. A woman may have desires, but she must not yield.
Little did she know that her own husband was engaging in this double standard. Once again, it was John Adams who recorded the situation in shocked detail after Franklin took him to dine with a large company of both sexes at the Brions. Madame Brion struck Adams as one of the most beautiful women of France, her husband as a rough kind of country squire. Among the crowd was a very plain and clumsy woman. I afterwards learned both from Dr. Franklin and his grandson, Adams noted, that this woman was the amie of Mr. Brion. He also surmised, this time incorrectly, that Madame Brion was having an affair with another neighbor. I was astonished that these people could live together in such apparent friendship and indeed without cutting each other's throats, but I did not know the world. A year later, Madame Brion found out about her husband's affair with this clumsy young woman, Mademoiselle Jupin, who was the governess of the Brion girls. She banished the young woman from the house, and then began to fear that she might take a job as Franklin's housekeeper. After Franklin assured her, in a closed-door session at his office, that he had no intention of hiring the woman, Madame Brion wrote him a relieved letter. "My soul is calmer, my dear papa, since it has unburdened itself into yours, since it does not fear any more that Mademoiselle J. might settle down with you and be your torment." Even before this fit of jealousy, Madame Brion had begun a crusade to stop Franklin from turning his attentions to other women, despite being unwilling to satisfy his ardor. "When you scatter your friendship as you have done, my friendship does not diminish. But from now on I shall try to be somewhat sterner to your faults," she threatened. In a forceful yet seductive reply, Franklin argued that she had no right to be so possessive. "You renounce and totally exclude all that might be of the flesh in our affection, allowing me only some kisses, civil and honest, such as you might grant your little cousins," he chided. "What am I receiving that is so special as to prevent me from giving the same to others?" He included in the letter a proposed 9-article treaty of peace, friendship, and love between the two of them. It began with articles that she would accept, followed by ones declaring pretty much the opposite that he would accept. The former included one saying that Mr. F. shall come to her whenever she sends for him, and another saying that he would stay with her as long as she pleases. His stipulations, on the other hand, included one saying that he will go away from Madame B.'s whenever he pleases, and another that he will stay away as long as he pleases. The final article of the treaty was one on his side, that he will love any other woman as far as he finds her amiable. He added, however, that he was without much hope that she would agree to this final provision, and in any event, "I despair of finding any other woman that I could love with equal tenderness." In describing his sexual desires, Franklin could be quite salacious. "My poor little boy, whom you ought to have cherished, instead of being fat and jolly like those in your elegant drawings, is thin and starved for want of the nourishment that you inhumanely deny him." Madame Brion continued the colloquy by calling him an Epicurean, who wants a fat, chubby love, and herself a Platonist who tries to blunt his little arrows. In another suggestive letter,
he told a fable about a man who refused to lend out his horses to a friend. He was not like that.
"You know that I am ready to sacrifice my beautiful big horses."
After dozens of such sensuous parries and thrusts had passed between them, at least on paper, Madame Brion ended up rejecting once and for all his desires for a more corporeal love. In return, she also abandoned her attempt to prevent him from seeking it elsewhere.
"Platonism may not be the gayest sect, but it is a convenient defense for the fair sex," she wrote. "Hence, the lady, who finds it congenial, advises the gentleman to fatten up his favorite at other tables than hers, which will always offer too meager a diet for his greedy appetites."
The letter, which concluded with an invitation for tea the next day, did not end their relationship. Instead, it took on another form. Madame Brion declared that she would henceforth like to play the role of an adoring daughter, and she assigned to him the role of a loving father.
"It is to her father that this tender and loving daughter is speaking. I had a father once, the best of men. He was my first, my closest friend. I lost him too soon. You have often asked me, 'Couldn't I take the place of those you regret?' And you have told me about the humane custom of certain savages who adopt their prisoners of war and put them in the place of their own dead relatives. You have taken in my heart the place of that father."
Franklin, either out of desire or necessity, formally agreed.
"I accept with infinite pleasure, my dear friend, the proposal you make, with such kindness, of adopting me as your father," he wrote.
Then he turned philosophical. It was, as he had said of Benny and Temple, important for him, now that he was separated from his own affectionate daughter in Philadelphia, to have always some child with him to take care of me during my life.